Okay.
This is Sierra Dalla with Municipal Sustainable Energy Forum, and today we're talking about different technologies that cities can use to gain some income or jobs and businesses, and which ones have been the most successful. And Jerry Braun's going to start us out. Go ahead, Jerry.
Thank you, Sierra. Thanks for convening this. I think it's a very important topic. Let me know if I go over, get to 2 minutes. I'm going to talk about kind of the high profile suspects in two categories: money saving and income generating. In the money saving category, local government projects, there are basically two that I'm familiar with. One is in both our county and our city, we have virtually net metered community scale solar projects. In one case, in our city, the project got done a long time ago, and it's on a brownfield site. And what virtual net metering means is that the project is behind a meter, but the excess production from that project is credited against a bunch of other usage behind other city meters. And the same is true for the county project, but the county project is three or four larger sized projects, but the same principle. And in both cases, neither the city nor the county had any skin in the game in terms of money outlays. And another money saving project is on-site solar that is, for example, at our wastewater treatment plant site. And on our schools, it's not virtually net metered. It's actually providing power for those facilities. On the income generating side, I think the two things I want to mention are renewable natural gas production at wastewater treatment plant sites. We actually do that in our city wastewater treatment plant to a limited extent. We don't sell the renewable natural gas, but it is used to power the digester systems. Community-wide, I will say on the renewable natural gas, this is becoming very very common and popular. There are 160 operational projects already producing renewable gas and feeding it into local gas distribution systems, and another 150 or 60 that are in the process of design and construction, or at least being planned. And the income generating part of that is basically the gas that's generated needs to be converted from biogas to biomethane, and basically that costs something, but then the city or county can sell the gas to the distribution company. And basically a couple cities, if you want to look up renewable natural gas in Honolulu or renewable natural gas in Portland, you get an idea of how this does provide income for cities and counties. How am I doing on time, Sierra?
You're fine. Keep going, Jerry. You're interesting.
Okay. Well, the last thing I want to talk about is not necessarily, if you look at local on-site solar deployment locally as a city or county project, it has some significant both cost-saving and income-generating aspects. We have in Yolo County about 12,000, we're a small county, 200,000 people, but we have about 12,000 on-site solar arrays that generate 12% currently of the county's overall electricity use. And that's a significant thing, and it saves money for basically, the people in the county, the businesses in the county. It avoids the cost of imported electricity across the county by about $50 million a year. Creates about $40 million worth of per year worth of job creation benefits. And it's about $500 million worth of taxable investment. Solar is is not taxed on, it doesn't add to the property value until in California until the property changes hands. So this it's a kind of a delayed effect in terms of income for the counties and cities. So I'll leave it at that. Look forward to hearing what others have to say.
Yeah, very interesting. Okay, Craig, you're on the line. Do you want to go ahead? And I'll unmute your line for you. Hang on here. Or do a 4-star. It should unmute it.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, yeah. Well,
all right.
Good day to everybody. And I'm gonna be brief because Sierra has asked that this call not dwell too much on solar microgrids and solar, and that's the area that the Clean Coalition has been the most active. But I will touch on two activities, two projects that are indicative of many projects the Clean Coalition works on with cities and counties and other school districts and other types of municipalities, and plenty of other types of facilities as well. And those are solar microgrids, and this is a really opportune way for municipalities to save a lot of money, like what Jerry was talking about. These are behind, solar microgrids are behind the meter, so there's net metering generally in play, and then the energy storage allows a lot of that solar generation to be time shifted, so that it can provide additional economic benefits in the form of time of use arbitrage. Energy has different values at different times of the day in California and in many other markets. And then there are also, when you get to commercial scale, most rate tariffs are include demand charges, so you can time shift the solar to also minimize demand charges. So solar microgrids have a tremendous economic opportunity / benefit that they provide to the sites, and they also deliver obviously environmental benefits, and then they are also generally configured to provide resilience benefits, where the solar microgrids can provide indefinite solar driven backup power to the most critical loads at a site. The Clean Coalition just got unanimous approval from the Santa Barbara Unified School District in out here in California to move forward with 6 solar microgrids at their 3 high schools, 1 of their junior highs, and then their centralized food warehouse plus a district office. So there's 6 sites that are going to get solar microgrids. There's an additional 8 sites in the Santa Barbara Unified School District that will be getting just solar only, because the economic benefits were not there to provide for the storage to be part of the picture in 8 of those sites. And or there just wasn't enough solar siting opportunity to make sure that a solar microgrid would be able to provide the resilience benefit, because the resilience benefits are extremely valuable. The last thing I'll say about the Santa Barbara Unified solar microgrids is that there is a great article that was written about it. It's available on the Clean Coalition website. I can provide it to Sierra for distribution, but it's a very succinct and colorful article that talks about that the Santa Barbara Unified School District will be saving almost $8 million over the duration of these power purchase agreements, which are 28 years. So they'll be saving $8 million in guaranteed bill savings. And in addition, they'll be getting an additional $6.5 million in value of resilience for free. So the sites where the solar microgrids are going, they either have, you know, very valuable inventory, which are frozen and refrigerated foods in the case of the food warehouse, centralized food warehouse, and also at each of the sites has its own freezers and refrigerators for food, you know, service at the at those individual high schools and whatnot. And then there are also communications and emergency sheltering facilities at most of these sites as well. So there's tremendous value in ensuring that the critical loads never go out. And by the way, solar microgrids can maintain 100% of the loads for a significant portion of the time, but they have to maintain 100% of the critical loads. Where they have to maintain the critical loads for 100% of the time, right? And that those critical loads have to stay on all the time, right? They cannot go out. So this article that I'm referring to, Sarah will distribute a link, and y'all can read about the details, but really tremendous savings, bills, guaranteed bill savings, which is obviously economic benefit to a municipality, which in this case is a school district. But same story, we're working with City of Camarillo and some other cities and counties. It's the same story, right? No matter the municipality, it's guaranteed bill savings, and that's obviously a huge economic benefit, or can be a huge economic benefit, like in the case of the Santa Barbara Unified Schools. The other example I want to point out is we've worked with the City of Palo Alto very closely, we being the Clean Coalition. We've done a number of projects with the City of Palo Alto over the years. And one of the projects was to help design and implement a feed-in tariff program. City of Palo Alto has its own, runs its own utility services, including electric utility service.
Craig,
yeah.
Let's not get into feed-in tariff right now because it's that's a whole topic by itself.
It's fundamental to what I'm at the point I'm getting to, Sierra. So just bear with me for another 30 seconds.
Okay.
The feed-in tariff enabled the opportunity to then engage the Clean Coalition to design and administer a request for proposal process to get a third party to lease the tops of the five city-owned parking structures in the City of Palo Alto for putting solar parking canopies there. And you know, as you can imagine, parking structures have very little load. So they're not candidates for net metering because you have lights and maybe a elevator, right? There's almost zero load, and the top of a parking structure can host a boatload of solar. So you've got to have a way to monetize that solar. In the case of City of Palo Alto, they have the feed-in tariff program, which allowed that solar to get monetized. It was a necessary piece of this puzzle. Which then allowed for the city to get lease income by having a third party come in and lease the essentially the tops, the solar parking canopy space, the airspace above the top floor of the parking structure, which, you know, there's parking on the very top of the structure. And now there's a superstructure above that with solar parking canopies. And so the city gets lease income for basically what used to be just, you know, empty, you know, there was nothing going on there in that space above the top floor of the parking structure. So I'm going to leave it at that and happy to take any questions that folks might have.
All right, good. And yeah, I'm glad you continued. Sorry about that. All right. So, Michael Walton, and one thing I would like all of you to think about towards presenting is where can some of these policies be implemented, these different technologies across the country? What are the limitations also? And I don't want to get into that right now, but that's one of the things I'd like to have answered before we quit here today. Michael Walton, let me see if I can unmute you, or see if you can unmute yourself with a four and a star. Nope. Okay. Michael, are you there?
Yeah. Yeah, can
right.
you hear me?
I can hear you.
Michael
Walton is with the Green, what is it? You tell me.
Green Spaces.
Green Spaces in Chattanooga. Yeah, there you go. All right, go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, so we are a 501c3 sustainability nonprofit in Chattanooga. Our mission is advancing the sustainability of living, working, and building in Chattanooga and the surrounding region. We work both in urban communities and in the rural counties outside of the city. But I guess to the point of this call, there were just a couple things that I really see as good potential strategies for cities, especially as it relates to increasing employment. One is that we haven't talked about as much, you know, is energy efficiency. And especially in cities that have substantial housing stock that was built before 1960, there's a real opportunity for cities to incentivize and in some cases even mandate efficiency improvements in a number of ways that help drive job creation, especially for, you know, relatively low-skill jobs that are quite easy to train for. So we have a program called Build It Green, which is part of the AmeriCorps network. So we're a core member. We're very much looking forward to the Biden administration's plans for a civilian climate corps. And I think that's one of the reasons why I would so highly recommend this strategy, because I think there's going to be a lot of opportunity for cities to leverage federal funding to help ramp some of these programs up. But basically what we do is it's a 6-month program that we teach both sort of community organizing skills and green building sort of trade skills, everything from insulation and air sealing to sort of light mechanical, light electrical, and light plumbing. And the financing mechanisms that exist, I think, are really, really compelling. So, you know, whether that's just leveraging like the low-income home energy assistance program and the weatherization assistance program, or expanding that through on-meter tariffs, so like pay-as-you-save. I think there's like 62 utilities in the country that are using pay-as-you-save, which basically, you know, it's a very low-cost financing tool that caps the repayment at 80% of the savings on the electric bill. And the repayment is tied to the electric bill so that it can transfer ownership in much the same way that residential PACE was intended in theory but doesn't really work in practice. So when it's tied to the electric bill, though, it's much more effective to be able to transfer ownership, and it also is effective at bridging the sort of landlord-tenant split incentive, which is a big hurdle for a lot of communities. But, I mean, I would argue in general that dollar for dollar, cities investing in efficiency is going to have a better return on investment, both in terms of the local economy and in terms of jobs. So I would tend to encourage cities to start there and then look at investing in renewable energy, you know, after they've really maxed out their efficiency programs. The other thing, and it's sort of related, that I would encourage everybody to keep an eye on are green banks. And so in some cases, these already exist at the state level or, you know, in some cases they exist at the municipal level. But, you know, I know just as an example, the Connecticut Green Bank mobilized over $1 billion of investment into the clean energy economy, and it created an estimated 13,000 jobs in the state, which is, I think, 7.5 to 20% of total job creation in the state of Connecticut over the Green Bank's first 5 years. And there's bipartisan support for these, so we really expect a federal Green Bank infrastructure to be part of any infrastructure package that passes this year that's focused on climate change. And so if
if you're a city and you don't have a green bank, or if your state doesn't have a green bank, then I would really encourage you to start now at working with your local CDFIs to make sure that you're ready to hit the ground running when that federal funding comes available.
Okay.
Those are my two things.
All right, super, thank you. All right, onward here. Mark Scully, we're going to try to stay more towards technology. I'm sorry, I didn't want to interrupt you, Michael, but it's more towards technology than towards process or policy. So, Mark Scully, what kind of technologies are you looking at in Connecticut that work for cities? And I'll unmute your line. Hang on here. Hang on. All right, go for it.
All right. Hi, everybody. That was some really interesting stuff that we're hearing. One project that we've been working on, and we is People's Action for Clean Energy. We're a Connecticut-based nonprofit. We work with towns and municipalities, typically with volunteers, clean energy task forces, and municipal planners to help them benchmark energy usage in the town and then put together an energy plan and plot a path towards a clean, renewable future. And one of the battles that's been picking up in Connecticut, and I'm sure in many other places, is the challenges of siting solar. We've had a lot of controversial hearings before we have as a Connecticut Siting Council. We had one in my hometown that was very controversial. And so prodded by the desire to not be taking up so much agricultural and forest land, and encouraged by some studies we'd seen that had been done in Rhode Island and New York, we set about trying to quantify the potential for putting solar on impervious surfaces, primarily parking lots, but also other surfaces. And so we've got some interns with GIS skills. They've found some data in Connecticut, and we're sort of working town by town, really using this data and doing some fairly granular modeling of what the solar potential is, informing, really helping a town to understand how much potential they have for using property that is quote-unquote, already degraded, right? And typically, very often, with multiple co-benefits, right, of not just protecting cars, but, surfaces, areas that can be used for farmers markets and sort of resiliency stations. So, and we're finding, we're sort of in the middle of the project, that the potential is massive. There are significant obstacles, it's really interesting, Craig, to hear about the feed-in tariff you've got. We need something like that here. So part of what we're doing is, in addition to doing individual town studies, we're putting together an estimate for the entire state of Connecticut and want to then advocate for removing some of the obstacles, including just the financial, that some states around us have more favorable tariffs for for carports. So we're hoping even under the Biden administration, the incentives for this type of thing will be even better. But it's a great way to get a lot of solar, distributed solar right next to the loads, great for resiliency, and really lower the town's energy costs, and really save our agricultural lands and forests. So it's been a really interesting project, and I'm sure this data exists in many other places as well. So if anybody would like more information on what we're doing, happy to share that.
All right. Thank you. Richard Chase, do you want to talk a little bit about what's been working in your town as far as energy is concerned? And let me see if I can get you unmuted here.
Sure.
Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Okay, very good. Yeah, I can, actually. That's very good.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Sierra, and all the other presenters. I think there's a couple things I would like this second. First of all, the efficiency first makes a lot of sense. The particular technologies And I'm interested that the wastewater treatment, biogas, landfill gas being used ideally for firing at a wastewater treatment plant. It's surprising how many instances of a landfill and a wastewater treatment plant being co-located. Basically taking your landfill gas plus your biogas coming off of the processing of the effluent makes wonderful fuel. We have seen numerous instances of solar on various buildings or at sites, ideally brownfield sites or disturbed sites, not necessarily prime agricultural land. In our area, unfortunately, due to snow loads and all costs of carports and that type of installations are significantly higher. We also have a lot of, I would have to call it, less than ideal marginal agricultural land that nothing's being done with it because often the cost of fuel to run a tractor to grow corn or hay is more than the value of the commodity that you're producing. So we have substantial amount of just idle land and farmers who would say, I'd love to put solar on my land because it doesn't make money any other way. So I hear the idea of don't use all the agricultural land, but then again, look at what else you can do with it. The other things I would look at is how to structure the deals. And this has been mentioned in passing on a couple of these. However, some of the key things are, as a nonprofit or municipality, you are not eligible for investment tax credits or depreciation. Those cover a significant portion of the cost of the system. Obviously, it's decreasing, although in the most recent bill, it was actually extended for solar. However, the preferred solution is that a private owner install, own, and operate for a period of time, that period of time being equal or greater than depreciation, and then the municipality having the opportunity but not the obligation to purchase it at a fixed price later on. This transfers a lot of the risk from the municipality back to the developer, and this is key. I have seen instances, I'm painfully aware of one large project where the municipality purchased it. The system did not produce anywhere near what was projected, and the cost overran substantially. A very awkward situation for the municipality. And that's why structuring the deals as a PPA with a optional buyout later on keeps the developers honest too, because they know if they don't produce, they're on the hook. The other thing I'd like to highlight is looking for the person from the municipality to be involved. You have to hire the person who has the gleam in their eye that gets excited about this stuff. We have a community college nearby that has a 1970s uninsulated cement bunker-like building that is now running over 100% renewable electricity, and they are heating the buildings with wood chip boiler. Absolute success story. He's got solar on the roof. He's got both electric and thermal for a new building, which has a swimming pool. And they have a couple 750 kW wind turbines on site and wood chips. So he is renewable in one shape or another of basically all of their energy. On the other hand, I'm well aware of another organization that they have a solar system that, as far as I can tell, has run for approximately 6 weeks out of 5 years, because nobody will go and turn the switch on. And I know this because accidentally the switch did get turned on for about 6 weeks and the system was actually producing. That organization has been also featured on local news channels for building a large wind turbine that has never run in years. So it's really key to have the right people involved with the operation. So, and of course, I've seen a number of cogeneration systems. They are problematic, whether you have microturbines or diesel gensets or natural gas-fired gasoline engine-based systems. And the reliability, the maintenance, the monitoring, all of these systems take somebody to monitor and maintain them. And if you don't, they aren't going to produce much of anything. And that gets back to why you need the person with the real interest in it to be in charge of it. So that's kind of my thoughts on it, and we'll take questions as time permits.
Oh, thank you very much. That was good. Okay, so Sherry Gruder's on here, and Sherry, I'd like to see if you have anything to add to this. You've been working really actively over in Wisconsin. She's just with the University of Wisconsin, done some amazing things over there. Just briefly talking about different technologies. I know you've worked a lot with cities on solar. Just real quick here, Sherry. Sorry to surprise you, but...
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes, we're all good. Uh-huh. Yes.
I am really not prepared to talk about this at this point, although I really appreciated hearing what's going on. I think the reason why it's probably not helpful for me to add in is because right now our state...
Sherry, I can't hear you very well. Do you want to pick up your phone? It sounds like you're on a speakerphone or a headset or something. You're really kind of mushy sounding.
Yeah, I can't do better than how I am now, so I think maybe it would be not a good time for me to talk.
Well, go ahead and try. Maybe other people can hear you better. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that there's just so many problems with the state of Wisconsin in terms of net metering. You know, we don't have a good net metering program. We have so many restrictions in terms of third-party solar and PPAs, where the utilities really want to own everything. That a lot of the wonderful solutions that I've heard, we just can't put into place here, except that we're in the process of changing that. So I'm hopeful, but there's not a lot I can share at this point. I think that would add to what everybody else has been able to say.
Okay, Norman, you had something you wanted to say. Let me unmute your phone so you can talk. Go ahead.
We both unmuted at the same time.
You're good right now. I can hear you. Yeah, just briefly here. We're trying to keep it down. This is more of a list than it is a long discussion about each of these topics. I'm just gaining information here for what we need to talk about and webinars for cities in the future. So go ahead, Norman.
Yeah, I've talked to the people at the state several times that are in charge of the various landfills. And they welcomed the opportunity to move ahead and talk about doing the solar on landfills. Of course, we did one here in Annapolis, and that's going along very nicely. I just haven't taken the opportunity to take it to the next step, but I look forward to doing that. So if anybody wants to talk about moving ahead with solar on landfills in Maryland, we can do that at some point. You can just send me an email.
Okay. I'd like to investigate a couple other topics here in the area of energy. Does anybody have any experience with heating and cooling with lakes? I know Toronto's doing that. Do you know of any other cities that are doing that successfully? Anybody? You can unmute your phone with a 4 and a star.
Hi, Sarah.
Go ahead.
Barry?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Cornell University uses their...
And who's speaking?
The Cayuga... This is Richard Chase.
Okay.
Ithaca, well, Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, uses Cayuga Lake for air conditioning and as their heat exchange facility.
Okay.
And Sierra, can you hear me? Sierra, can you hear
me? All right. No, I'm good. Uh-huh, go ahead and introduce yourself, please.
So this is David Kay. I work at Cornell. I was going to say that, but also...
Oh, David. Yeah, David. Right. Okay, go ahead.
So I would say yes. It doesn't really involve the municipality directly, only indirectly. You know, there's all sorts of permitting issues. And it was pretty controversial initially, but it is in place. And I would also mention that Cornell similarly is seriously considering deep source earth heating and cooling sources right now. They're doing some experimental work on that. So if that technology is proven, it could have pretty significant implications. We don't know yet whether it's going to be feasible or economic.
Okay, that's good to know. All right, so the other topic, if anybody knows anything that's going on, and I know Vancouver, Washington was working on
Sierra,
this at one time.
Sierra,
yeah, go ahead.
Sure. Can you hear me? This is Craig Lewis again.
Sure, Craig.
So the Clean Coalition has also worked very closely with Stanford University on a number of energy projects, and although the Clean Coalition didn't work on this particular one with Stanford, we're very well aware of it, and that is that Stanford has basically gotten the natural gas out of their university, and they've done that by going to a thermal energy storage and energy central energy system, and they have a hot water loop and a cold water loop that goes around their entire university. It's a state-of-the-art program. It saves them a boatload of money, and just to put this in perspective, they spent $500 million implementing it, and the return on investment is in the teens in terms of internal rate of return. So it's become a huge economic benefit to the university, and obviously provides a whole lot of environmental benefits as well. And that project, they call it the new central energy facilities. And there's lots of information on the Stanford website about it. So if folks are interested, that's a really – it's the best example that I'm aware of with respect to centralized heating and cooling and doing it in a way that is super environmentally friendly. It's 100% electric. It's not – there's no gas. There's a gas backup, but there's very small percentage of the energy that is used for heating the water. It comes from the gas. It's almost all through heat pumps, electric heat pumps. So I'll leave it at that, but that is the best example I'm aware of with respect to heating and cooling solutions like what you're talking about.
Yeah, thanks for that. And actually, I wish that John Motlock were on this call because he was involved with Ball State University, and they put in a very extensive heating and cooling geothermal type loop in Ball State many years ago, and I think it's been very successful as well. So, but good to know it's moving forward in different parts of the country. So the other thing is an interesting technology is the heat exchange with sewer pipes. Anybody know anything about that? That was up in Washington, Vancouver. They had a system going. I haven't been able to follow up on it, but does anybody know anything about that? No? I thought that was something that had promise. Okay. And district ice cooling, district energy. If you want to talk, make sure you do a 4 and a star to unmute your phone. Nobody?
Hey, Sierra, this is Shalom Plank.
Sierra, this is Baird.
Oh, yeah, okay. Shalom, why don't you go first since you got in there first, then Baird will take you next. Go ahead, Shalom.
Okay, sorry, Baird. On the sewer heat mining, there are some things happening in Washington, D.C. around that. There's the American Geophysical Union and also the new D.C. Water Headquarters building that are both using the sewer heat exchange.
Okay.
And we actually put in a concept paper for a much larger district east of the Anacostia River in conjunction with a large affordable housing redevelopment near a large sewer line to create, with water source heat pumps and the ambient temperature, you know, condenser water loop as a district energy solution. So we'll see if that goes anywhere.
Okay. That's good. Baird, go ahead.
So two things. There was a Philadelphia-based company who was trying to do the sewer heat exchangers, but they, you know what heat exchangers are. They're basically radiators. You know, they've got little sets of intersecting channels, and they clog up easily, and they didn't make it. So be sure that somebody has a technology that really works. And on the district energy, there are just umpty-ump examples of effective and valuable district energy systems all across the country. And if you want to know more, you should go to the International District Energy Association, or IDEA, website, just Google IDEA, and you will be plugged into more resources than you ever wanted.
Okay, super.
Sierra?
So, yeah, go ahead. Introduce yourself, please.
This is Richard Chase again. One other thing for micro-district energy, a pilot project is actually in the Massachusetts Climate Bill, which is in the process of being resubmitted after the governor vetoed it. But in there, they're looking at the gas utilities being able, since they have a right-of-way in the street, to put in a ambient temperature geothermal loop with feeds to the houses and to provide thermal energy to houses rather than gas. And so that project is close to becoming real. So that is another avenue which helps multiple things, from getting rid of the gas in the street, which the lines are often very old and leaky in our area, and the cost of replacing them to make them modern and not leaky is outrageous. So
where was that, Richard?
This is in Boston.
Boston, okay. Rick Greenstein might know something about that. He's in Boston. I don't know if you're on the call, Rick. He may not be. I thought he was. Yeah, you are. Go ahead and do a 4 and a star, Rick. And see what, do you have any, know anything about that? I can unmute your line. Oh, you haven't unmuted. Go ahead and talk. Theoretically, you should be able to talk. Nope. Okay, I'll see if I can do it from this end then. No, don't do anything. Just a second here. Let me try to unmute it. See if you can talk, Rick. Well, I don't know why you can't.
Sierra, can you hear me?
Yeah, there you go. Okay.
No, this, This is Charlie on a different note.
Oh.
So you might be confusing me with Rick, but I want to raise hand on something on renewable natural gas, but I'll wait my turn.
Okay. We have...
Sierra, this is Kevin Danke. You might have been thinking I was somebody else.
No. Actually, I was trying to get Rick Wiestein on here, but apparently somehow it's not unmuting his line, and I don't know why, unless he's on a computer-type phone. Yeah,
no.
I was going to call on you next anyhow, Kevin, so go ahead.
Okay, fair enough. Hi, everybody. I'm a new member. I'm really happy to be part of the group. We have something called the Clean Growth Incubator, and one of our main partners on that venture is Arizona State University. And they have a district energy facility, if you want to call it that, there for a kind of a cooling tower. They have over 1 million gallons, almost 2 football fields worth of water stored underground that they then use with cooling towers for purposes of cooling the campus. And they also have a huge array of solar power. And I agree with Baird that the IDEA website and that group, there are a lot of opportunities with district energy, and our country really has not taken advantage of it like Europe has at all. And I think we should all be looking at that very carefully as we advise cities.
No, that's a very good point. Thank you. All right. Rick, are you still able to talk or no? I don't know what's going on. I am. Is this Rick?
You heard me? You hear me now?
I can't know. Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay.
Do you hear me? Okay, good.
I can, but you need to repeat the question. I don't know what the question was. I had turned
Richard Chase was talking about geothermal loop in Boston. What do you know about that, if anything?
I'm not sure I know about that particular thing. My students, actually, you've had me on before to talk about what my students' projects done. Recently, my students made a presentation to the Department of Energy Resources on the potential for geothermal. They were extremely interested. It was very well attended, and the DOER is looking carefully at expanding geothermal, but I really can't tell you details beyond that.
Okay. That's fine. I just thought I'd see if you knew anything about it, but that's good. Okay, so onward with the list here. I think we've covered a lot of it. Am I missing something here? I mean, obviously wind and energy storage are all part of it, and we don't want to get into any one of these topics too deeply. I'm just trying to see where we're going with future calls and webinars. Anybody else have any? Yeah, go ahead.
This is Sherry Gruder from Wisconsin.
That's much better, Sherry. I can hear you clearly now. I don't know what happened before. Yeah.
Good.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to add on the municipal side that we had talked about RNG, and Dingham County, where Madison is located, uses the methane from the landfill to create RNG, and they've already changed over half of their fleet to RNG vehicles. But what they did that was different and is helping the local rural economy is that we have a lot of farmland, and the bio and a lot of CAFOs, or large animal feeding lots. And what they've done is they've actually allowed and made it possible for the farmers to be able to feed their biogas into the Dane County system, which cleans it and then puts it into a pipeline where it's bought, you know, as RNG across the country. So I just wanted to add that was a way not only that the county is making money and going, you know, carbon neutral, but also is promoting an ag economy around biogas.
That's interesting. And so this is Dane County, you said?
Yes.
Okay. And it's going into a pipeline. Where is it going to ultimate goal?
Well, what's interesting is California was going to buy a lot of that RNG, but once the once the farm biogas was put in, even though it's totally clean, that just because of the way the rules were, and maybe someone from California could address this, but it wasn't able to be piped to them anymore. So it did cause a problem in that respect, but it's just being piped to other states that, you know, are trying to fulfill their, you know, carbon reduction goals.
I'm surprised they have enough biogas to be able to do that. Of course, there's lots of animals in that country, but interesting.
Yeah, they're all building right. It up.
Sierra?
Yes, go ahead. Again, introduce yourself.
Yeah, this is Richard again.
Sure.
Sweden is doing a interesting thing where for the cities, they require everybody to have a garbage disposal. And so that you collect the organic matter via the sewer system rather than like San Francisco, which picks it up in containers via truck and composting. They run it all through the sewer system, take the gas from that, and that's used to power the city vehicles, the buses, and so forth.
Wow. Interesting.
So it's an opposite strategy, if you will, from what we're seeing in the U.S.
No, that's very interesting. Thank you.
Yep.
Anybody else have anything here to contribute that's a little out of the ordinary? So I have a question for Jerry. Jerry, and we'll open this up to discussion, but with the biofuel, do you know different parts of the country? Okay, what I'm understanding from this is there's a lot less regulations on biofuels than there are on some kind of energy for electric production. So would that, some of these technologies work in most parts of the country, or are there still regulations that they have to deal with? Jerry, you want to unmute your phone, 4-star. Here, I'll get you. Never mind. Here. Okay, go ahead.
Obviously the regulations vary from state to state, but in I think the one thing that is probably worth mentioning is that there are standards for injecting gas into gas pipelines, and they're pretty stringent. So those are the main obstacles, I think. But what I'm seeing happening is that California is importing a lot of renewable natural gas from dairies and basically dairies are among the very best sources of feedstocks for producing renewable natural gas, and there it's also the most carbon negative thing you can do. One thing I want to make clear in case other people haven't thought about it because it's kind of obscure, but it's much, much better to burn biomethane than it is to allow it to seep into the atmosphere. Organic material is going to decompose, and that does produce methane when it's done, when it's in an anaerobic situation. So I don't know whether that helps, but the standards are pretty uniform across the United States.
Okay, well, that's interesting. Okay, so that's an interesting way for cities to make money then, too, and not necessarily just on the electricity. Any other thoughts here? We got other things to talk about, but am I missing anything? Go ahead. Introduce yourself.
This is Charlie Howland, just following up on two things,
both
sure. Relate to RNG. So a very good resource on, I think, the economics of RNG is a group called Energy Vision. They're based in New York City. I think it's Patricia Underwood is the head of it. So Energy Vision, good source of information on how to make RNG sort of economic. And just to sort of put a pin in what I think the previous speaker said, problem with RNG out of landfills is that the contaminants are much different and more corrosive, primarily something called siloxanes. The technology is there to deal with it, but even that technology requires a lot of maintenance. And I've worked now on two projects that were combined solar and RNG on a landfill. And in both cases, these are both in Minnesota, in both cases, they ended up shutting down the RNG and for a time reverting just to venting it into the atmosphere, you know, which is not good. And then they add sort of a flare system that's just burning it, but is not, you know, is not helpful. So, you know, hence the often better economics for farm-based methane. That's all I got.
Okay, thanks. Well, Sierra? It looks like we're out of time. Yes, please, go ahead.
Richard, I have just one last thought. And looking for a biochar maker that is something like a farm scale, because, of course, we have lots of brush, we have lots of tree limbs that just keep coming, but, you know, there's very small biochar. Basically, you take a 55-gallon drum and so on and so forth. And then there's a few very large ones, and I haven't found anything that would qualify as, you know, in-between scale.
Okay. Yeah, biochar is very important. That's another topic, but I agree with you. That's
right.
Something not discussed very often, but it's an extremely important product. So, okay. Well, we covered a lot of ground today. You know, if you have time, anybody who talked about these technologies, if you could just summarize it in a paragraph, a small, short paragraph for me, that would be very helpful. I've taken notes on it, but it would be very good if you could just put it in your own words so I can have this, and we'll start working on some of these and tackling them one at a time. I want to get them into webinars as well because each of these topics is a lengthy topic in itself. So. But I think we covered a lot of ground today. Thanks, everybody, for coming, and you know how to reach me. Got my phone and email.
Sarah,
yeah,
Sarah.
Go ahead.
This is Craig. I already sent you little one-sentence explanations and links to some colorful details for each of the three things I mentioned to you, the Santa Barbara Unified School District Solar Microgrids and the City of Palo Alto solar park and canopy lease arrangements and the Stanford University solar hot and cold water loops. So,
okay.
So you have those for me already.
All right. And on a personal note, I got my first COVID shot yesterday. So yay.
Congratulations.
Yep.
Yay!
It is working. It is happening. It is happening. Thanks to our governor and to Kaiser, they both did a good job. Okay, guys, we'll talk to you next time, and we'll have a couple, you know, calls in the early part of February. I know what I want to do, but I don't have them scheduled yet. So, okay, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Good conversation. All right.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.